The factory is a fertile body, each breast a beginning. I make geometry of the meat, and that keeps my mind in line, calming, comforting tenders, and perfect fingers. My pneumatic scissors make sense of the mess. It's 10 to 4 when I arrive on the floor in my sexless scrub top, and number 5 is pissed. I slip on my disposable arm wraps, then tie my plastic apron behind my back. Everything that drops into our section is mostly peach with pale yellow lumps of fat. Thank God there is no blood. When I'm not at work, I remember moving the length of my fingers over each smooth breast, feeling for the catch of bone or a string of tendon against my latex glove. Number 5 catches me missing a breast and shouts. I look up, then cut faster to catch up. Trembling flesh flops and tumbles down a conveyor belt at 140 birds or more a minute, and I cut, cut, throw the pieces into wide emerald vats to be sorted. It's hard to focus, and sanitizer fogs my eye protection. This morning, the sky was July clear, and as I walked through the glass doors glittering with dawn light, I knew something was different. I couldn't stop squeezing the skin of my stomach. In the locker room, I pressed my hands deep into my hips, searching for the nubs of my pelvis through the surrounding paunch of my sore, spongy fat. During first break, I swallow back the nausea warming up my throat. I step outside and walk past the rows of parked cars, the sun barely rising and the constellation fading out in the north. Mama calls it the Northern Cross. God is watching over us, she would say. But when I moved out and got the internet, I looked it up. It's not a cross, but a swan in flight. The air outside is normally swollen with blood and animal waste, but today it smells earthy, like wild grass and fresh milk. The mild country across the highway is peppered with paste-colored double wides, old barns, twined bundles of hay, our factory nestled neatly between that and a few acres of chicken farms, if you can call them that. Oblong, warehouse-sized huts with thousands of clucking broilers breathing in their shit. We're the kill station, the biggest poultry supplier to Missouri, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. When first break is over, workers sort into their sections like marbles rolling towards one uneven end. Number 3 shows up next to me. Good morning, number 4. I nod and cover my nose with my paper mask. My hunger prods, and pressure in the muscle of my jaw below my tongue makes me salivate. A bloat sits below my belly button, achy and full. I try to remember the last time I bled. 3 weeks, maybe. It's never been regular. Sometimes it takes months, but always I'm thinking, she's here again, inside me. An alarm rings and the assembly line clunks on, first from the adjacent warehouse rooms, then ours. Air hisses through the hose of my scissors, and I ready the blades by shaking them open and shut a few times. For the rest of the day, I cut and cut and cut.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome to episode 605 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I talk to the novelist Elle Nash about her breathtaking new novel, Deliver Me. The chief topic is how to write a strange, nearly impossible story about American poverty without wallowing or romanticizing one's characters and finding beauty in their ability to strive to understand a maddening world. Since I last shared an episode, 2 weeks ago, I gave a poetry reading called In Buzo Veritas and then briefly appeared in the Loose Lips reading series here in Orlando, that is the city beautiful, and then co-hosted a type-in at the Kerouac House that proved pleasant most. About a dozen visitors came by to peck out some words on those antique machines just a few feet away from where Jack Kerouac did the same thing when writing the first scroll draft of his follow-up to On the Road the Dharma Bums. As for Enbuzo Veritas, everything went exceptionally well, I think. Except for the recording I tried to make. Unforced error number, let's just call it infinity. All right, let's talk to L.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today is L. Nash, the author of Deliver Me. In Deliver Me, Daisy is an overworked employee in a relentless Missouri chicken slaughterhouse, obsessed with becoming a mother in a world in which happiness seems like an impossibility, and even the pursuit of happiness is a maddening, desperate prospect, told in one of the most beautiful, intoxicating first-person narratives I've ever read. L., thank you for giving me some time.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So this is one of those books that conveys such an ugly America so beautifully that I'm once again charmed. And as someone who, I don't know if I grew up redneck or just redneck adjacent, but as a recovering, overeducated person, this is a book that speaks deeply to me. It's a very unique voice. And it's one of those books where I find it difficult to imagine the starting place. It's such a delightfully constructed book. Partly I'm fascinated, like, how on earth does someone write this book? And on the other hand, since it feels like a miracle, I almost don't want to know. But that's the nature of this show, is we try and share notes and figure out, how does a book like this get written? So yeah, could we talk a little bit about that? How such a claustrophobic, impoverished world that this is set in, and yet you don't condescend to the material, but you do elevate it with a narrator who's very perceptive, despite the fact that there's a lot about the world she hasn't figured out. So I think I've just thrown a bunch of paradoxes in the air and go, okay, explain it, make it make sense.
But no, you're good.
How do you come to write a book like this?
Well, I mean, I think it's several things. So the first is that I also grew up with more of a blue collar background, even though my mom and I are both from England, my dad was in the army. And so in the late 80s and the early 90s, when it wasn't as, I guess, profitable. So I did grow up, you know, my mom was working like three jobs while my dad was away all of the time. And we were stationed in the South for a large portion of my childhood. So, I mean, I have a lot of memories of kind of just living that life. And then, so that's one side. And then I also had lived in Arkansas for a time, which in Northwest Arkansas in the Ozarks, which I love. I'm so in love with the country. It's so beautiful. Living in the woods for a time, it is really calming. The people are very distinct and that sort of thing. And it's kind of this thing where, as a person who's used to living in working class conditions, you get used to being very resourceful no matter where you live. So there's a lot of that in my own personal experience. But the other part is that when I was living in Denver, there was this crime that happened in the city around 2015, and I could not stop thinking about it. And not even in the sense that I was like, I want to make a book about this. It was more just, I could not stop thinking about the fact that the person who committed this crime was so obviously struggling and mentally ill and living in their own kind of constructed world that no one around them seemed to notice until it was obviously too late. And I don't know why that fascinated me, partly because I think that the United States is really bad at letting people slip through the cracks. We don't have a good mental health care system or healthcare system in general, and those kinds of things. And that maybe that pulling apart of community, those are the ways that these people end up falling into these traps. I'm concerned with that, and I'm interested in those things. And I think all of those things coming together created what this novel was.
So that epilogue, it's not exactly an epilogue, but yeah, the news story at the end of the novel is the germ of the story. And I've experienced that where I see a news story that is so perplexing and unsatisfying. And I realized I don't want to be exploitive and go, yes, I found something juicy. But on the other hand, it seems like an unanswerable problem that a newspaper is inadequate to try and explain. And you almost wonder, what is the point of a newspaper doing that? Of saying, here is this completely mysterious, unfathomable event, and we'll just leave that there. And then what is it they used to say on the news? And next up, or And now we move to this topic and you're like, wait, no, that horrible thing demands an explanation or at least a long moment of silence or something. And so this book seems to be a response to that. Your answer to how could someone end up committing this unimaginable crime?
Yeah, it's like, and now here's to Tom with the weather. I understand what you mean. I know I have such a pained relationship with news media because my degree was in journalism and where I wanted to go with writing was I wanted to be a reporter. I wanted to like work in that world. But something about it for me, you have your ideals. When your ideals come across the reality of something, you're like, no, this is not how it's supposed to be. But yeah, I guess I suppose it is in a way an answer. And it's also wanting to look at this issue in a way that doesn't make it a spectacle because it is really easy. This is why news media reports on these things that are unusual. That's because it sells papers, it sells for their advertisers. And people do get interested in it and they do get interested in the spectacle. But when you do that, you become more interested in the drama and less in the empathy side of it. And I think that's for me where I sit with it is I wanted to bring people on this journey with it to see if I could cultivate this sense of empathy, because I had empathy for the situation in the novel.
I hesitate to reveal too much to the listeners because they should buy and read the book. But let's just say a very pregnant woman was killed by someone and for deeply upsetting reasons, even more than the normal reasons that for why women are, I don't want to say routinely murdered, but would not be wrong to say are murdered every day. The one time I did that where I'm like, stop everything was I live in Orlando, which if I want to feel very civilized and sophisticated, then you go downtown. And then if I want to live in the country, you just drive 20 miles in any direction and you're deep in the country. But years ago, a child was killed by an alligator at Walt Disney World. And the New York Times article really demanded more questions than it answered. It was just so perplexing that I'm like, this is not right. Whatever they're saying doesn't make sense. And also I could see how much confusion it caused the general world who doesn't know that place the way I do. And they're like, well, how could Disney let this happen? And I'm like, because it's a swamp. It's a swamp twice the size of Manhattan. And there's theme parks in it, but it's a swamp. The alligators are home. You're visiting the alligators. And they do monitor the wildlife. And this was an alligator just not quite big enough to get dragged out of there, but big enough to snatch a small child playing right next to a sign that was saying, don't go in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and probably especially more surprising for people who have probably never lived anywhere near alligators or something like that. It's very interesting.
No, it was a family on vacation from Nebraska. It's like, it wasn't a Florida family visiting Disney that let that happen.
Yeah, and it's curious. That reminds me of, so living in Colorado, you get used to puma and bears. And like in Yellowstone, which is close-ish travel distance, there are people, I saw this video of people who like saw bears on the side of the road, like a mom and her cubs. And for the photo opportunity, they're like running towards the bear. I don't know if I was missing context of it, but it was a bit like that lack of awareness around things, or maybe like, right, like going hiking without having the proper protection or something, where it's like, there's scary things. There's scary things in America. America is very big. It's not just city.
Yeah, I guess having grown up, not that outdoors, it'd be outdoorsy enough. Wildlife can kill you. That's something that you should appreciate and not simply think, oh, they look adorable. Yes, that doesn't mean they're not capable of killing you. So let's talk about your writing background and how you came to write such a beautiful book. Because on one level, I feel like this narrator maybe should be communicating mostly in monosyllables. And there's this real alchemy where that thought I have, wait, is this narrator not just smart, but have a sophisticated vocabulary? Is she hiding her reading? Only an afterthought, because reading the book, I'm just completely absorbed. And her way of looking at the world, despite the fact that we could see some of her limitations, her not seeing everything, she seems to see too much and not enough at the same time. But it's written so beautifully that I'm just in for the ride. For all the hairpin turns in the book, I'm very much in for the ride. And I realize that's got to be a strategy, since so much of the book is about pain and suffering and yearning that seems so desperate. And yet, I don't want to say it's fun to read, but when the book is in my hands, I don't want to put the book down. Can you talk a little bit about that tension between creating that voice and writing in that voice and conveying the world of that character.
Yeah, thank you so much. Sometimes it's hard to say because developing tension sometimes feels like an intuitive thing. I feel like my favorite thing is when the draft is already done and I can go back and edit, because then editing feels, it's just like a natural process. It's almost like, it makes me think of like Edward Scissorhands carving at the creatures out of the bush, where I'm just like, oh, it's already here and I can just do whatever I need to bring the detail forward. But a lot of where I learned how to write, part of it is just growing up reading a lot and that sort of thing. But when I decided very seriously, I was like, I want to write fiction and learn how to write fiction instead of just like trying to pull it out of my head. I want to learn from somebody. I want to try to publish, which is not something I thought that you could do until like 2013. That's only 10 years ago, which is a little bit embarrassing, but it's fine. You know, I've figured it out at this point. But I sought out Tom Spanbauer, who taught Chuck Palahniuk in the 90s. That was how I learned about his workshop, the Dangerous Writing Workshop. And Tom has this philosophy that you should really bring the reader to their knees. And a lot of what I've learned is just through that. And I think he also, that comes from like the Gordon Lish school of thought too, where it's just a bit, either it's full on or it's nothing. But for Tom, where he differs, where Gordon Lish is more, he's like the stylist. I think Tom is like a feeler, where he's like, how deep can we go to examine this psychological fear or process or the places we're afraid to go from all facets? How do we keep the reader in this fictive dream as deeply as possible? And so that's kind of the way that I approach anything that I write, or even that I edit if I'm working with other people, because I have students and clients that I work with too, is, does this keep the image in my mind? Am I feeling it in this moment? How can we go and start from the body with our feeling, rather than saying, I feel scared. There's ways that we feel scared that we know that we're feeling scared, and we feel it in our body. And sometimes those things are unique. And so I try to approach it that way too. The way that one character feels scared is going to feel different from another. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I try to really approach it that way. And I also do aim to try to write without a lot of judgment on my characters. I do want people to like draw their own conclusions. And I think that works to help. For me, I think it helps to draw me into a character when I see writing like that. That I'm allowed to like make my own decisions about this character or this narrative or where it's going without having it told to me. I think about those things as I'm writing, and I think the skill set that I try to develop and dive deeper into, it's always changing. I think every time I read something that moves me, or you know when you read something and you get really jealous, but not in a negative way. You're just like, oh, I really wish I'd written that as a writer. I try to think about why I like it, if I could break it down other than it feels good to read. I learned from that. I learned from everything that I read in that way.
One of my mentors, David Lipsky, when reading good work, we would say, what could we steal?
Yeah. You figure out, why does this specifically work? And sometimes, that helps you just kind of build on that a bit.
Well, and I think not judging our characters and just letting them be themselves. I don't know if empathy is the right word, because I think it might be more intense than that. It feels more intense, certainly in Deliver Me, where you're kind of hurling yourself into the character. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's how I feel as the reader. And it lets their vulnerabilities come through. And I think there's something so refreshing in that, and so beautiful in that, even despite the great darkness of the story. And I say this, I don't know if every reader will have this feeling reading the book. I guess it depends on your familiarity with Deep South religion and what your feelings are about that. But it just seems so oppressive to me. But Dee Dee, as she's called, Daisy, is such a character who I feel horrible for, but I feel so wrapped up in. And if you had an agenda, I don't think that would be possible. Like, oh, I am writing this kind of character and the audience will feel this way. It's like just trying to understand her and let her exist as herself as fully as possible seems to be the agenda, not, oh, this will be this kind of literary book. Does that make sense? Mm-mm.
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah. And I don't know if maybe this is what you're getting at. Sometimes I feel like I read narratives of the working class or the South, and it feels a bit like, I guess to be crude, it's like poverty porn, where it's written with the exact intent of eliciting feeling sorry for a particular subset of people. And I don't want to do that. And that's not my aim. I really do just want to write through this experience. And so maybe you're right. And maybe when I say empathy, maybe that's the wrong moniker. It's more, I'm seeking to understand the set of circumstances that could drive a character or a person, because this has happened. This is a fringe crime, but these are things that have happened before. What set of circumstances drive a person to this and put them in this situation, especially with regard to mental health? And I guess in writing it, I'm like, are people willing to go with me on that exploration? I don't even know if I began writing it with this intention of being, everybody's going to read this and I have a particular reader in mind and these are the types of people that I want to read my book. I think I was more just, I'm obsessed with this concept, this crime. I'm obsessed with how and why it happened and what society is like around these people and even how society responds to it. A big part of living in the South is, especially when it's surrounding issues of motherhood, is there's a lot of, you bump up against a lot of traditionalism. And so being pregnant in the South, you're above a first-class citizen. But being a mother, or even a mother that's not in a traditional situation and doesn't go to church and stuff, there's not a lot of support for you. Mm-hmm. It's very hard. And so that dichotomy and those social pressures and all of those things, I just wanted to examine in that way.
Well, I think also part of the appeal of this book for me is how unsafe it feels. And it probably has so much to do with not having an agenda or a political thesis. Oh, this is what I think about class in America, and this is the way it plays out, and my novel will prove this thesis. I think on an existential level, all of those things kind of exist in the book, but not in a stable way where I could feel the hand of the author saying, this is the way the world works. The emphasis is definitely on one person's ability to process the world, which is more than enough for a great book. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I like that because I think I'm always trying to process the world. The lifelong process.
Indeed. I think it's time to wrap it up, yeah, if we have it all figured out. I think that might be my favorite kind of book, are the unsafe books. The ones where when you reread it, it stays interesting and you keep thinking. Mm-hmm. I think of Fahrenheit 451, which it's not a bad book, but I feel like, yeah, I read it and I was like, yeah, I got it before I finished the book. And I think Ray Bradbury has better work out there. I don't mean to bash Ray Bradbury, but I think my favorite work, it kind of operates on an open system.
Yeah. I think there's one story that feels formative for me, even though it's been years since I read it, was Harlan Ellison's The Beast That Shouted Love at the Heart of the World. And it is a short story about, I think it is based off of the Texas A&M shooting, which is the very first school shooting that happened in the 1970s. But for some reason, that story and the concepts in it have stayed with me for so long. And that it feels the same way too, because later on, I was a teenager when I first came across it. But later on, when YouTube was a thing, I found these interviews with Ellison where people were, why do you write so much about violence and all of these things? And I guess I'm also a fan of like that kind of work where it's a bit open-ended. No one's saying Harlan Ellison is an obsessive murderer, but he's examining this kind of topic for a reason. But you can kind of puzzle it out for yourself, I guess. It's more just a fascination with all facets of human experience. It's a good question. I'm thinking now, why do I enjoy that? I had my goth book club just this past Sunday. And so I run a goth book club, yeah. And we read a book that was quite, yeah, I would say also unsafe. And we all asked this question, why do we like dark literature? And there was so much discussion around it that, I don't know, it was really eye-opening. I think one person said, it like deepens their well of understanding human experience in a way, or it's the ability to experience the fears or thoughts or something like that they may not otherwise be able to. It's always a hard question.
Well, also, I experience a great amount of anxiety. And my life is overwhelming. I think I told you, I sometimes feel like I'm working in a chicken slaughterhouse and I'm just trying to keep the line moving, which is dehumanizing. And in the case of Dee Dee, of course, it's dehumanizing while also just dismantling chicken after chicken. The chickens themselves were never allowed to mature into actual sentient chickens. They never really got to be real chickens. Mm-hmm. But not in a poverty porn kind of way, but inhabiting her mind for a while kind of makes me feel a bit easier about mine. Like, okay, she has to process worse things than I'm processing right now. And it makes, I don't want to say therapeutic, but I think it rehumanizes me a little bit to do that.
Yeah.
And as you say, the event that you're writing about isn't normal, but it's real. It's a statistical anomaly, but that doesn't make it not real. So to go back to the Harlan Ellison question, why do you focus on violence so much? I think the assumption behind that question is what you write is entertainment. Why does entertainment have to celebrate violence? Which, of course, is a very superficial way to look at his work. I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream was a formative story for me. It just keeps getting more and more bleak. And you're like, I didn't imagine how bleak the world could be. By the way, now I want to have AI intelligence into just write essays about that story. And I wonder what would happen.
Yeah, that would be good.
But the assumption is that he's doing this for kicks. And that feels quite wrong to me. And I do think, because he's such a good writer, it may feel like, okay, he's so good at this. How wrong is it to write so well about violence? Which is similar to one of the things I love about this book is the things that you're writing about, the voice is so beautiful and mesmerizing, and yet the material is so dark. As a writer of literature, I think it's important casting a spell, giving us a reason to want to stay once we start. I never want to read literature that's just supposed to be good for me. Fuck that. Not interested. And as soon as I feel that, I get aggravated. And it's actually a question I ask myself from time to time. I kept writing these horrible man stories. First person, unreliable narrators. Oh, here's a horrible man. It isn't that funny. And here's a horrible man. And I think I'm poking at important things with those stories. But after a few, I'm like, am I doing this just because I'm good at it and because I think it's fun to celebrate how miserable men are? And I think I've slowed down. I've tried to come up with better Batman than simply celebrating awful men.
Is it celebrating or is it just demonstrating and exploring? Because I think when you're saying that about Allison too, it reminds me of when Lana Del Rey, the musician, was first getting really popular. People were like, she's glorifying suicide and she's glorifying all these bad relationships. But really, isn't she just exploring the atmosphere of it? That is a good question. Because is it entertainment because I wrote it, or is it entertainment because you're feeling entertained? And does that mean that I did it because it's entertaining, or does that mean I did it because I'm exploring something and you feel captivated? It's a very philosophical question.
Well, and as a writer, I think it's important to go with whatever your move to write. Oh, this is happening. All right, let me see where this goes. In my case, I think I had done a couple of really good ones and I saw myself doing one more and I'm like, let me hit pause on that. If someone asked the question, isn't this just celebrating assholish men in a world that already celebrates assholish men? I would like to be able to have a moral answer, not simply a glib one. I don't know. I'm allowed to. but I do it so well. Kind of like Tarantino, I think, has given up on having a serious conversation about violence, even though I think there's one to be had, but it's all everyone wanted to talk about in his work. And I think he's just given up and he goes, I'm allowed to do it. It's fun. Shut up. And I don't blame him because of how often that he's had to have that conversation. But also in the case of Lana Del Rey, who I don't love her music, but on the other hand, if that's where she's driven to go, I think it's kind of dumb to criticize that. It's okay not to listen or to go, yeah, I think I got it. I remember Nine Inch Nails. I'm like, you're still mad. Okay, got it. And then when he got less mad, I got more interested again.
Mm-hmm. Wait, when did he get less mad? Which album was that?
I think when he started doing instrumentals and... And he may have gotten less mad before that, but I just remember it was like, he's doing just instrumental albums now. I'm like, okay, let me go check that out. And, but I remember a decade after he came out and he's like still mad. I'm like, I don't know.
I think I'm so funny.
But of course, what I'm doing is questioning myself, which I think is also a danger for writers, is just having self-doubt and going, wait, should I really be doing what I'm doing? I think it has something to do with the pull. And that sense, I don't know if I believe in the sacred, but the closest thing to the sacred is when you have an audience that deeply cares about what you're doing and they invest in what you're doing. And so when I feel like I'm onto that, not simply, oh, let me try this out, or, oh, this is, wouldn't this, or if I think something is too funny, I'm like, okay, that's just for me. But when I feel like I'm really onto something or building something that can have that sense, okay, give that everything it needs. I feel like I've been talking a while and I haven't asked a question. But
you're good.
So you've got this news story that's maddening. And this isn't a story. This is a giant, horrible question that the newspaper article doesn't even seem to understand as a question. And you're like, this question will not let me go. How does that turn into the beginning of a book?
Yeah. Well, so the news story, I had come across it before. So I'm a mom. So I came across it before I even was a mom or anything like that. And I think before I even was even thinking about being a mom or anything like that. But fast forward a few years, And as far as my writing life goes, I was trying to write into another novel and I kept rewriting it and getting to the middle and then getting stuck and then never finishing it. And I was, why does this keep happening? And I was a new mom, so I was fatigued and had all this brain fog, and I just didn't feel as sharp as I knew that I could be. And so I remember sending a version of this novel that I'd been working on to my mentor, and she was, I just don't feel like this is dark and intellectual because I know that you're capable of. And I was so wounded, but it was great. I'm always all for honest feedback, but I was like, fine, I am going to write my basic bitch novel. That's what I told myself. I was like, I'm going to teach myself how to write a book. I've only ever done it by the seat of my pants. I've only ever not planned and not outlined and just thought I could write it all the way through. And I was like, how do normies do this? Let's pick up some how-to books. Let's figure out what a plot is. Let's look at what the three-act structure is, because I don't have an MFA. I didn't have any formal teaching. My workshops that I did with Hans Spanbauer were all feeling based. It was all, let's work on this story and just keep expanding it and like go where that expansion takes you, which really does, it can work for some people. And it did work for my first novel, which is Animals Eat Each Other. But to get to a complete first draft of that novel, I think it took 3 or 4 years. It was all in process all the time and very fluid. And so for this, I was impatient and I was, I'm just going to figure out how to write the regular linear narrative, just write this novel. And so after reading a few craft books, I had concocted my plan. I did an outline of all things. I always knew where the ending was going to be. And I even created a plot graph on this huge piece of butcher paper that I had taped up to my kitchen wall. So that way, anytime I had a spare moment, if the baby was napping, if she was busy, if I had 10 minutes or whatever, I could sit down at my kitchen table or at my countertop and I would just be able to write from beginning to end. And so that was pretty much how the actual bookmaking process started for me, was 2 weeks of planning and then setting this goal of wanting to finish the novel, the first draft, in 3 months. And so I just did that. I just did it every day and I did not look back. And the first draft was awful, but I then had a first draft. I think I finished the first draft in like 9 weeks. And once I did that, I
So
was
that's
so,
that
I'm
was
so
well under the
sold.
deadline you set for yourself.
Yeah, I'm so sold on the process of planning. And if you have a specific concept that you have in mind, I'm so sold on that process, because having that first draft, it took 2 to 3 years to really refine it into a place where I wanted it to be, but it was so much easier having the whole thing completed. And so I'm like, I know I should be doing that now and I'm not, but I'm really sold on that process. I really love that. That was how it became the book itself. It went through a lot of drafts though, maybe 7 to 9 from inception to the book that people can have in their hands. It's a lot. I'm pleased with it because just through that process of letting go of the outcome and letting go of my fear of failure and letting go of what it might sound like or be like, this is just going to be my bad novel, I was able to actually transform it into something that I feel pretty decently proud of. I still look at it and groan sometimes when I'm reading it, but it's out in the world now, so I can't do anything about that. That process itself, yeah, I'm going to do that again.
Do you still have the butcher paper?
It's somewhere. I don't know where it is. It's probably folded up in a box somewhere, but I do still have it.
Yeah, I think for a lot of writers, and I sensed it in the way you were talking about it, the idea of outlining feels anti-creative, which I think underestimates how chaotic our minds are, because when you actually go to actually write the outline out, surprises will come, is I've experienced. Was that true for you?
Yeah, I think so, because I was able to at least know in my head where I was going when I was feeling stuck, like I was always getting stuck in that middle point. This time I was able to kind of get over that. And the other thing is that, as I outlined, if things didn't really work, if I couldn't figure out how to get to point A to point B, I actually could just figure it out there, take my time thinking about the outline itself rather than doing it in the book itself. My friend Chelsea Lane Wells, she's also a writer. She made this comment to me once that trying to like edit a novel is like standing on a planet and looking down. And I've never forgot about that because I'm like, it's so true. Like when you're in the bulk of a book, it feels so impossible to see the whole thing. So having an outline when you're trying to get some of those details right, it really helped me. But it also helped me not to be too rigid. If while I was writing it, like when I was going through my process of A to B without looking back, if something felt like it should change as I was writing, I just let it happen. And then I made a note on my butcher paper I just would let it go. I wouldn't be too rigid about sticking to it. Because there's a reason why. It's like you talk about the pull a little bit. That's a bit about, to me, that's like following your intuition in a way. Sometimes people believe when you are writing these things, when you're in that flow state, maybe you're channeling rather than creating, you know, like you're pulling something out of the ether. If you feel pulled to a particular direction, your intuition is definitely telling you something. It's fine. You don't have to be so rigid and stick to the outline all the time. You know what I mean?
Totally. So you were a new mom when you were working on this project, and I imagine the process also helped what I presume would be more fragmentary mind state, which is to say, you couldn't just say, okay, the world does not exist, only my book, and now I am pure. It was time you probably had to fight for, maybe not the ideal time when you would have wanted to do the writing. Can you talk a little bit about how the outlining maybe helped collect your mind in a way that worked when your mind maybe wasn't in its purest form to be able to write purely? Because I think for a lot of writers, that exists when we're in our MFA, when it's like, I have devoted these 3 years to do it. And it's like, and my life will just be, no, your life will not be like that once you get out of your MFA. Probably it won't be like that. So could you talk a little bit about the upside for just being able to work more regularly and how it helped your mind?
In the midst of the project itself, knowing this is what I was doing, it was definitely fragmentary. Having a newborn is the best boot camp for writing because you're always going to sit down and write no matter what, in the sense that like you have to force yourself when you have the free time. You can't just like wait for inspiration to strike you. So you get really good at just cutting through your own bullshit and just being like, all right, here we are. Instead of being like, oh, I don't know what to write, or I'm afraid of the page today or what have you, because that's the time you have. And then it helps you really let go of that fear of it being bad. Like I often find that I think when people talk about writer's block a lot, I think what they're actually talking about is there's a confrontation with the self that has to happen of letting things not be as good as you want them to be in the moment and not getting it done. And the outline, having that outline there for those days when I was like, I don't know what to write or I don't feel like writing, but I know that I want to do this if I want to hit this goal, it really allowed me to just say, okay, here's 500 words from A to B in my outline. We're not going to look at it. We're not going to edit it. We're going to write the words. We're going to close the document. And then we're going to come back to it tomorrow. And then we're going to see how we feel. And so having that, those little steps, it gave me the guidepost to say, you don't have to run great. You don't have to run fast. You just have to get to the next guidepost. That really helped with when having that outline and knowing like, where that ending point was going to be. So.
Yeah, you can give your novel a makeover, but the novel has to exist to be made over.
Yeah, I definitely think so.
So, how did writing in first person affect that process? Because the novel that I meticulously outlined in a way that had to be very plotted because it was a half satire, half bona fide adventure story, like Indiana Jones. And it's like, yeah, the sequence of events actually have to be meaningfully related. I can't just have random psychedelic fun. But I was writing in third person so that if Homer nods, as Horace said, if the prose is just workaday and functional, I didn't feel like I had broken the book necessarily. Not every sentence has to sparkle. Whereas with first person, I feel it's a much different spirit. So did that make it harder to just keep going and going, yeah, I'm not going to judge it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to keep moving. Or are you more disciplined than I think I might be?
Well, I actually wrote the very first draft in third person,
Ah.
but on reading it and then even sending it to, I think I did send that first draft to my agent, he didn't feel connected to the character and I didn't either. And the first part of me was a little bit indignant about it because I was like, she has sociopathic tendencies. People are not going to connect to that emotionally. You know, there's a reason why we don't connect to that. But then understanding literature and why we're writing what we're writing, I did realize that the error with the third person in that first draft was that the psychic distance was actually just too far away. And so I like writing in first person because it actually increases the closeness with the psyche of the character that you're reading. And I really enjoy that. And part of it is because I feel our internal monologues are naturally first person. And so it's easier to meld the two when you're reading, if you do it well. There are some tricks to it. I can't do sentences that are like, oh, I like the time. I think that bumps us out. But if you can master that sense of first person where you're kind of hiding the eye, melding that, the internal monologue that we naturally have with like the reading world, it can happen very naturally. And it's always exciting to me when I'm reading a book like that. And so I guess that's part of how I was like writing third person in that draft first. But there were times when writing first person where I'm thinking, almost method act in my mind as though I'm this character so I can get these scenes through or figure out where I'm at. I'm writing about these experiences, a lot of experiences I've never had before in my life. And so I have to really visualize what those experiences are like. So for that, when I'm feeling stuck or anything like that, I will actually do a lot of heavy visualization practice. Sometimes method acting techniques, I've been researching a bit of those. I mean, they help me kind of just bring those things forth in my mind. But I'm really visual as a person as well. I do guided meditations 3 times a week that are all very visual. I tend to see things and scenes and colors and moments and atmospheres and like that kind of thing anyway. So maybe that's sort of a thing that has helped too. What do you think as a first person writer?
Well, I could see the benefit of writing in third person and then translating to first person and how the path is already there, but then you could feel the entire thing getting juicier and more alive. There's a heartbeat to it when it's first person and everything takes on the flavor of this person's self-expression. And I think it's not automatic what you're talking about in terms of visualization. It's possible for first person to be as flat as third person, but I also think slowing down and trying to get the reader very much into the moment with us is really important. I remember part of my education as a writer came from the movie based on a play, I think it's by Hour 11, Death Trap, where they were writing these mystery thrillers. And when in doubt, there's an established playwright and a new playwright in the film. It's Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve. And they're like, all right, let's act it out. Okay, is this believable? Would this work? And they would act out these scenarios to see, does this play out or does this not play out? Which on a fundamental level is just, oh, that's so fucking simple. Why didn't I think of that? When it comes to killing people, okay, you stop short of that. But, and hence the tension of a play called Death Trap. But it could just be as simple as, okay, let me go do what my character was doing. And then what do I observe? What feels special? What might make the scene more alive? Which also saves me in moments when I may be overtired. And sometimes I feel I have great imagination, which unfortunately means also when I don't have it, I also know, oh yeah, I feel really flat right now. How can I feel less flat? Go act it out sometimes helps me out.
Yeah.
But I haven't tried guided meditation. So can you tell me a little bit about how that helps?
Yeah. So a lot of it is depending on the kind of meditation you do. A lot of it is just you're listening to someone's voice move you through different scenes. And a lot of times it starts with, so I would say how guided meditation helps with visualization is when you're listening to it in your mind, you're in there, but someone else's voice is speaking to you. So the burden of the meditation part of like telling your mind where to go is lifted. If you kind of surrender to someone's voice telling you like, to think about or how to visualize things, it's a little bit easier to get to that point. And so just like anything, just like working out or anything, it's a skill. It takes practice. Sometimes in general with meditation too, starting off becomes really hard. You don't want your mind to surrender to the sound of this person trying to guide you to think about white ball of energy, or if you try to visualize a rose sitting in a bell jar or something like that, you don't want to surrender to it right away. And it becomes hard to think about. But over time, what happens is you let your mind chill out, it just becomes so much easier to pull that up. And so you can take that as a writer and you can think about the things that you've never experienced before. And you can sit at your desk very easily and just practice what that could be like. And through there, then you pull using like the 5 senses or whatever it is you can think of, you free ride or whatever, all of those details out. I think Lee Strasberg, who's the founder of method acting, one of the exercises that it makes me think of is the coffee cup exercise. This is how it starts. You just sit. It's not like you're drinking an actual cup of coffee, but you're literally just sitting and visualizing a cup of coffee. And this exercise, he asks students to do it over and over again, as much as possible, until they can truly get every detail of the cup of coffee. And I think that can be very useful for pulling from experiences where you can't go and do the thing. Or you're like, this is my writing time. I can't just go up and like take a walk. I'm going to sit here and write. You can sit there and you always have your mind to like help you through that process. But it is a practice.
So I found the beginning of the novel deeply interesting in that a lot of the information is withheld. For example, our narrator, Dee Dee, she's living with someone named Daddy. And it took me a while to figure out that was a nickname and that wasn't her father. And there's no point at which Dee Dee offers a basic exposition to begin the novel. It begins in medias res. This is my life. This is what I'm thinking about. And different characters come in when they show up in her life or she thinks about them. But there isn't a bracketed, oh, and by the way, dear reader, I think of Humbert Humbert being kind of exaggerated in his ability to unfurl a history of people and then shift. And I suspect that may be a strategy to help keep getting us deeper and deeper into the novel, because I didn't see where I was going. And it kind of got me used to abiding with some mysteries while enjoying the reading. And the more I learned, it didn't mean mysteries didn't keep coming up. So I wonder if you could discuss that strategy. And I imagine it didn't begin as a strategy. It just began as the way the novel came out. But what your thoughts are on not holding the reader's hand quite so tightly and letting the reader come along or not, based on how much we want to spend time with this person rather than having a neatly unfurling story.
Yeah, so it's a couple things, actually. I was like, I can pinpoint them all too. So the first one is that for my first novel, my friend Julia Escoria said that there was a lot of exposition in it when I was asking for her feedback. And I had to actually, as a baby writer that has no idea about any of this stuff, had to be like, what the hell is exposition? What does this mean? What does it look like? Why is it too much? So I had to like research that a little bit and understand it more. But then there were two other moments when working with writers whom I love. There's Corey Bennett. One thing that he said once while giving feedback, this was years ago, was he said, resist your urge to babysit the reader. And then the other thing was the author B.R. Yeager, he wrote Negative Space, just had a short story collection come out. And he said this tweet once, so he's a horror writer. And what he said was, nothing is less scarier than knowing what the fuck is going on. And I was like, that has stayed with me so much. And I think just having those three writers' voices in my head telling me that over time just made me feel more cautious and aware of what I was explaining and when, in a way. It's not even necessarily, oh, I'm going to withhold this to create a tension or something. I think that part came naturally because of the nature of how explaining things does dispel the tension. But thinking about it more deeply, it is, in a way, if you allow the reader to figure it out for themselves, I think they're going to feel more connected because they're kind of investing by thinking about it. And so I do think it's very useful for that reason. I think that's why a horror movie, for example, can feel so tense, because we're invested because we're puzzling it out, everything that we don't know. And so, yeah, I guess that's just, it's really stayed with me, especially that tweet. Nothing is less scary than knowing what the fuck is going on. It's very true.
The scariest moment in a horror movie is when we think the movie's over, but the credits aren't rolling. And we're like, what's going on here? And of course, normally it's going to be some dumb jump scare. Normally they don't live up to the tension. It doesn't get better than that moment of tension, normally. But yeah, that sense of, I don't know what this scene is for. I don't know what this is about, but we're here. I think also of a statement Billy Collins made about poetry, which is, in a good game of poker, there are some cards that are face up and there are cards that are face down. And it's really important to know which ones make for a good game if you're creating a game of poker. If they're all down, then the reader has nothing to work with. Too much mystery, it won't work. But if there's no mystery, it also might not work. Mm-hmm. So part of my thought process was, oh, she calls him daddy. I'm like, I'm not sure why. And then I think, okay, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and that was Big Daddy, and everyone called him daddy, and that was weird, but became normal through their usage. And like, I just, but it took me 30 or so pages to figure out, oh, this isn't incest. We're just that deep in her mind that, because we're eavesdropping. This isn't a conversation. This isn't her going, oh, by the way, dear reader, far away from Jane Austen. And so you think it's advice that you absorbed and then it just happens.
Yeah, I think so. I like the idea of presenting a story as though you're eavesdropping on the character. That's a really good. Yeah, I just have been thinking about it for a long time in terms of what you reveal and when. And it's hard to know. Sometimes it is an intuitive process, but sometimes it's much more difficult to know what to reveal and why. And maybe that comes from having like people who are willing to help work with you and give you those fresh eyes that you don't have, so that they can see it from like a completely new place and ask the questions that need to be asked, so you can determine, is this a question I want to leave unanswered, or is this one that does need to be answered?
Yeah, I don't know, as a writer, I think I began as this messianic modernist who was just a nightmare. It's like, it's just pure consciousness, narrative is a crime, and I would have been unbearable in the 1920s, and I had no idea what it was doing. So when I get feedback and people are like, oh, I feel a little bit less clear about that, I'm like, okay, good, I'll fix it. And they're like, oh, well, I'm not sure. I'm like, I have no qualms about doing that. I do have faith I'll be weird enough in the end and surprising enough that I won't overdo it. It's so refreshing when someone can pinpoint, this is the point where I really had no idea what that was about. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to have every idea, but some idea is good.
Yeah, it's good. You have to breadcrumb people to keep them interested.
Well, and I did notice that too, where names get dropped and then we get more information later.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're just really good or if that was part of the revision process of deliberately placing some breadcrumbs. I don't want to introduce this character halfway through the book, even though they don't really have an important part. So was there any of that in the revision process?
Well, part of that probably came from early on in the book, there were way more characters, actually. So this is more craft focused. There were so many characters and it was just a lot. And I think I can't remember where exactly I learned about this idea of just bringing in more focus. Literally, I'm like, someone should tell me if they couldn't remember. There's this idea that everybody loves to put their whole lives in their first novel. So it can tend to feel like really unfocused. And so this idea of creating focus by compressing the multiple characters into one, the idea about fiction is the lie that tells the truth truer. And so you're wanting a concept that you're trying to express somehow. You don't necessarily need 20 characters to do it. You can likely give people the same atmosphere and the same feeling and the same truth that you were trying to tell with 5. It makes it more simple for, I think, a person to follow if that's what they're wanting to do. I mean, so maybe some novels do require 20. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's where I was coming from, where I was having a hard time with all of the different subplots at that point. And so I did compress quite a few and then like made some last minute changes because of what I was trying to express with some of the other characters. There's stuff about Sloane that I was like, I'm not feeling like in this final draft, it's really cementing the way that I want. And so I made some changes and stuff there with it.
Sloane is the friend character that we never mentioned so far because we've had so much fun talking about the craft of Sloane the story rather than...
Her teenage crush / childhood friend.
The anointed beloved child of the town.
Yeah.
Who saw through the town and the town loved her anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like I haven't wanted to spoil the contents of the story itself because I do feel this is such a remarkable reading experience and I don't want to take that from readers, but this is one of the most exciting books I've read in a long time.
Thank you. I really appreciate hearing that.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank L. Nash and Isaiah Portillo for editing this episode. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, Heartbreaking Comic Book Reviews by Drew Barth, and of course, reviews of cinematic masterpieces by our curator of schlock, Jeff Schuster. Until next time, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.